You're listening to Raphael Epstein.
Josh Nelson joins me to talk film. His musings on film can be found at filmology.com. It's spelled with a PH. Hi there, Josh.
Good afternoon.
Look, we're going to do satire. We're going to talk about the new... It is Cronenberg, Map of the Stars, isn't it?
Oh, it certainly is.
Oh, yes. Josh's favourite, David Cronenberg, the director, has made Maps to the Stars, which is very much a satire. But we're going to start with the third Hunger Games film. It is satire, too, of a type. So if you've got, you know, films that really skewer politics, anything, community, film communities, journalists, we know what satire is, something that tries to, either with humour, often with humour, sometimes not, really tries to pick all the holes. Let's start with Hunger Games 3, though. I want to give you, I tell you what, we're going to start with... A little bit, actually, of the song by Jennifer Lawrence. Let's start with the song. Now, I have not read the Hunger Games books. This is the woman who's basically, you know, she's got to save the rebellion, right, against the bad, big bad capital. She sits down and sings a song. It's actually quite remarkable that she can sing so well. Have a listen.
Are you coming to the tree? They strung up a man. They say who murdered three. Strange things that happen here. No stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you coming to the tree where a dead man called out for his love to flee? Strange things did happen here. No stranger would it be if we met at midnight in the hanging tree. Are you?
I like that because I'm just stunned that this woman has won an Oscar, acts in films really well, and by the way, she can sing. Just there, you know, by the by. Josh,
triple threat, quadruple threat. Can she dance? That's
probably
the next thing.
Well, yeah. She danced in Silver Lion Club, which is pretty
quadruple threat. There you go.
Yeah, there you go. She can do everything. She is, look, and she actually is, she's remarkable, I think, in lots of ways. But look, it's the Suzanne Collins trilogy, the Hunger Games books. They've divided the third book into two films, which is either a piece of crash commercialization or giving the story the space it deserves. Take your pick. Josh, I mean, the basic setup for those who haven't seen the film. So, I haven't read the books.
Do we need to recap the first two?
No, look, the basic setup of the film, they give people an idea of what the fuss is about, I guess, if they're not familiar.
Well, the third film, Mockingjay Part 1, carries on directly from the end of the second film. Now, the first two films are the Battle Royale, kind of Lord of the Flies scenario. Children will battle in the arena till only one remains, or two if there's a couple left.
Reality TV to keep the serfs at bay.
Supposedly.
Gladiators
indeed.
To keep the serfs at bay.
And at the end of the second one, if people can remember, Katniss is, well, not kidnapped, she's rescued from the Hunger Games arena to be used as a pawn in the upcoming rebellion led by people like Philip Seymour Hoffman and character played by Julianne Moore.
Who's great. Of
District. This is the Julianne Moore double today, actually.
It is.
Who's the leader of District 13. Thought demolished, but really have been busy militarizing under the underground, ready for the assault. And this is really what the part three is about, at least the first half that we see here. It's the preparation for the battle. And really, it comes down to the conflict of how Katniss, the Jennifer Lawrence character, is prepared to be a pawn in this propaganda war, basically. And I thought, as far as ideas go, this is the most interesting of the three
definitely.
So far.
Mm-hmm.
It's definitely in terms of style. I think it's another step up from the first two. And I think it was quite refreshing to get it out of the arena. Like, we sort of felt like we'd gotten that. If it'd done it again, it was, I thought you'd been flogging that horse, maybe one too many sequels.
Not for the every 12-year-old who's watching it.
Probably not, no. In fact, when you played that song before, I got flashbacks to the premiere that we went to, and the girl next to me was intermittently sobbing and singing along to that song.
Because she knows the words.
Which was quite an experience. It was an interactive thing. It was karaoke by Hunger Games. But actually, what I really liked about Mockingjay as a political satire, I guess, is the fact that the film seems to be equally critical of District 13 and the way they're using Katniss as a pawn, as much as they are Coriolanus Snow, the Donald Sutherland, the big bad from the Capitol. Almost suggesting that she's stuck in the middle of these kind of mirroring sides of political warfare, using sort of simulated propaganda videos. And I thought that was really good, that it didn't play easy sides in terms of good and bad. And it's really about, I guess, her moral choices that she has to make to try and survive herself, keep her family safe, and I guess the romantic subplot that comes in with choosing between the two men, which is a little bit Twilight-y and didn't kind of work for me. But really, it's the only thing that didn't sort of work for me in this film.
Look, I think the idea that she is pliable to the propaganda of the rebels, she wants to be part of it, but she doesn't quite want to be part of it. That's actually one of the key strengths of the film. I'll tell you why in a moment. Have a listen, though, because you've actually got the Philip Seymour Hoffman character here gathering a small group, and they're trying to work out, okay, if she's going to be part of, if Katniss, the character, is going to be part of the propaganda video, okay, you know, it's like the advertising brainstorming session. What are the good things about her? Have a listen.
That's everybody. Think of one incident where Katniss Everdeen genuinely moved you.
When she volunteered for her sister at the reaping.
Excellent example. Okay. Now, I hope that wasn't important. Okay, volunteer for sis. Good. What else?
Oh, when she sang that song for Little Rue.
Oh, yeah. Who didn't get choked up at that?
Mm.
You know, I like you better, Effie, without all that makeup.
Oh, I like you better sober.
Okay, I made a mistake there, of course. That's the Woody Harrelson character, not Philip Seymour Hoffman. But I tell you where I thought the power of the film came from. First of all, I saw it with 3 12-year-olds who were completely devastated by this film. We'll get into the violence perhaps in a bit because they loved it, but they were shell-shocked by it. I, who is used to things like The Walking Dead and Game of Thrones, I'm like, violent? That's not violent. So you do need to be aware of that. I think for kids, it has a huge impact. But what I loved about it is that, and this was the discussion I had with the kids I went with afterwards. They were like, wow, isn't it terrible that all the world's like this? But having the chat to them, war is actually kind of the metaphor for the choices that we all have to make. The idea that, oh, you know, you think that, oh, my parents are bad, or the big bad corporate job is bad, or school's bad, but actually, on the other side, when you rebel, when you take the reverse option, actually the darker side of life is there as well, and that there's always good and bad in whatever option, that there is complexity, that life is multifaceted, that being an adult, that growing up, that going on a journey is actually about really difficult choices. And I thought, as someone who hasn't read the books and wasn't a huge fan of the two films, there's a lot of power in that. And actually, I think it was actually the first time I thought, oh, right, I get it. Now I get why these films have such a devoted following. So I think it does that really well.
And she has gravity. I mean, she's always good. I don't think I've seen a film where I haven't liked her.
But yeah, she's remarkable.
The other thing that stands out in terms of the performances is Woody Harrelson, who injects such wonderful humour, as you heard there. I mean, those scenes just are elevated instantly. Yeah. And Philip Seymour Hoffman, I mean, it's kind of hard watching this film. There were moments that it went, oh, my God, he's fantastic. He's alive again. And then you twig and it's just, oh no.
He is remarkable, isn't he?
And they stand out. I mean, they elevate scenes. Scenes dramatically feel like they've just been lifted up imminently by their presence.
Well, I was actually thinking, quite a few films I've watched Julianne Moore and thought, oh, my God, you're acting everyone off the screen. But then Philip Seymour Hoffman's on the screen with her, and I don't know that he necessarily has better lines. He's just, there's something about, he's just completely, this person exists, that character is a real live, heart-beating human being. He's quite remarkable.
Yeah, he's got a more interesting character because he's played both sides, because he's been on the Coriolanus Snow side and he's switched over, where the Elmer Coyne, the president of District 13 character, that Julianne Moore, she's playing it quite straight, and it's really sort
but
of...
Isn't she supposed to be, if you're Katniss, this is the woman who you aspire to be. She's the leader of the rebellion. This is the path I'm on. This is the prime example of, if I pick this side, this is where I will end up. So there's supposed to be some depth and complexity there as well, isn't there?
There is. I think most of that comes from the Katniss character in terms of, yes, this is the woman who is the inspiring one, but also, hang on, I think this woman is manipulating me as well. So there's that, how much should I trust this woman? And it's, I think, one of the strengths of this, it isn't just the singular hero figure. I mean, it's not like an Expendables or a Rambo where you have the male hero goes and saves everyone. Yeah. One of the most interesting scenes in this is when there's a group of people that go on a mission towards the end, sort of on behalf of Katniss, on her desires, and she has to watch. And it's that question of war. How much are you willing others to step into your shoes for your own benefit and sacrifice their lives?
Which, I mean, it's pretty good. It's pretty multi-layered, multifactorial kind of film. I like it. And someone texting in about the hospital scene, which we'll say is like, it has the classic Gone with the Wind, Civil War,
just the spray of moaning, mauled, maimed people in agony, and she's sort of somehow their saviour. I actually found that quite moving.
That was, scene.
Yeah. I want to talk about Maps to the Stars, but just a brief note, Josh, on the structure of the Hunger Games film.
Yeah, well, one of the points that's being made in a number of reviews for this film is whether, as you mentioned, this is a cynical exercise in marketing, expanding the one book across two. For me, this actually felt almost the most coherent of the three so far, even though it is supposedly just half of the text. I mean, I thought the second one had a far more jarring end, sudden end, than this one does. And I actually thought this was a fairly well-rounded, and it didn't feel noticeably padded out. There are maybe some elements here and there, but I mean, you know, as people have been pointing out, Empire Strikes Back ended on a cliffhanger many years ago, so it's not exactly a new phenomenon.
Love it. I'm loving the idea that movies are just chapters.
Unlike The Hobbit, glorious. The Hobbit feels noticeably padded. 9 hours to tell a, you know, 200-page text. Look, anyway, let's not get onto that just yet.
I couldn't sit through the third Lord of the Rings film on the weekend. It was too long. Anyway, let's talk about Maps to the Stars. We'll play you a part of the film, but what is this about? It's Julianne Moore, David Cronenberg. What's the point? What's the story?
It's a pretty vicious satire on the vacuity of Hollywood and celebrity culture, really. It's an ensemble cast. Julianne Moore plays an actress, Havana Sagrand, whose mother was very famous back in the day. She's struggling to forge her own career, you know, being post-40 woman in Hollywood. And they're remaking the movie that her mother was famous for, her famous role, and she's vying for the lead role. And you have all these other sort of characters surrounding her, interconnected in various ways. Actors like John Cusack, who plays he's a curious therapist, and it's almost this combination of sort of reflexology with regression role play that he involved with her. And the key thing that links them all together is the Mia Wasikowska character, the Australian actress, who turns up in the opening scene off the bus from Florida into the bright lights of Hollywood, is met by her limousine driver, played by Robert Pattinson, and she wants to enter back into these people's lives.
Let's have a little listen to a small part of the film. This is the Julianne Moore character on the phone to her agent. Remember, she's trying to get the part in the film the remake of the film that made her mum famous. She's complaining to her agent about her rubbish problems.
I thought that Gary Marshall was going to be there, that it was a meet. I didn't know that I was going to have to read. And then they gave me the wrong drive on, and I had to walk like a mile, and I stank by the time I got there. And then the casting director, who I know, doesn't even acknowledge me. She just walks right by without saying a word. And then she tells me that she doesn't even know if Gary knows that I'm coming in. Now, this is Gary Marshall, not Bertolucci. His movies don't make money anymore, and I know Gary. And then she says they want to put me on tape, and I'm like, excuse me, but you need special makeup for that, or you look green. And she says, well, you can either tape or not. Like, it's all some pointless exercise, and I just can't take it anymore, Jacob. I'm so tired, and it's so pathetic.
So this is the excruciating, egotistical minutiae of really painful people.
It is, and she's extraordinary in this film. You know, the type of, the style of dialogue, the style of prose, the content of the characters' conversations is very reminiscent of sort of Bret Easton Ellis novels like American Psycho or Glamorama. You know, there's name-dropping left, right, and centre. There's, you know, people dropping names about consumer objects and fashion and so on. But what I think this film does really well, and I think maybe people, I don't know how people go in with different expectations given it's a Cronenberg film, but I think he's approaching this satire with a kind of an extreme sort of sense of symbolism. And the key motives here are incest, cycles of abuse, cycles of violence, and things burning down. There's lots of shots of the Hollywood sign, particularly one in front of a burned down building. And this is this sense that everything is just a cycle. And Cronenberg talks about this. This is the first time he's actually shot outside of Toronto, or within Hollywood rather. And he talks about the seductiveness and the repellent nature of Hollywood, and that strange combination of that too.
So what is he saying is seductive about it?
Well,
the fame, the
surface. I mean, the surface of Hollywood is this idea that everyone in LA is basically in the same industry.
Yeah.
Everyone talks themselves up. Everyone thinks they're God's gift. Everyone's in there for the dream that is celebrity. But on the underside of that, which is where Cronenberg really starts to kind of dig away and pick away the scabs, is this sort of dark underbelly, where it's sort of this belly of dark lies, really. And this is where these recurring motifs come in of incest and so on. And for every scene you get at like a flash restaurant or people drinking martinis or talking to each other like you heard there's scenes of kind of the abject nature, people vomiting, people on toilets and so on.
So is it a satire of Hollywood, or is it a satire of everybody's sort of ego and ambition?
Oh, I think it's pretty location specific. Right. I mean, I think you could generalize it outside of that to, say, celebrity culture, but I think the location is really important here. I think he's really commenting on LA.
So is it enjoyable, or is it witty, or is it painful? Like, what sort of experience is it?
I thought it was very funny.
Right.
I'm not sure that. I think the dark humor was lost on people because of how over the top it gets at points. And satire is a very hard thing to do when you're trying to make characters who are types and characters who are believable. And I think this manages to find that balance. And it's because you get the surface, the superficialities, but you also get glimpses where we see beneath those. And they're the really interesting parts, I think, from my perspective. It's dark. It's not a Cronenberg in the sense of like
old school.
So you didn't
laugh
Cronenberg
out loud funny, but you think it's.
I know, I laughed out loud.
Oh, you laughed out loud.
A number of times, but there was some.
So you're on your own.
And there were a few walkouts during the film because I think people.
So it's like a Robert Altman film.
Well, a little bit more extreme than a Robert Altman film. Okay. This is a bit beyond The Player. It's a bit more vicious than The Player.
But it was trying to, I guess, imitate life and also skewer it. And sometimes that doesn't work for everyone. You either think it's genius or boring. There's you can't half like a film like this. I'm guessing you either love it or you hate
absolutely. It. Absolutely. And look, as far as Cronenberg's recent work, Cosmopolis aside, because he wrote or he adapted the screenplay for that, this is the closest to a Cronenberg-like script that wasn't written by Cronenberg, and I think that's really important.
Okay. Let me read a few of your texts on satires. Forgive me for neglecting them. You've mentioned some great ones. Adaption by Charlie Kaufman. Oh, Life of Brian. Thank You for Smoking. Yes, from Lindsay in Mount Eliza. Someone else, Brazil, Terry Gilliam. Oh, Brazil's just extraordinary. I stood next to him once, Terry Gilliam, in a queue, and had to stop myself getting down on my knees and saying, oh, my Lord, that was just the most amazing film. The same texter, though, saying, I'd hoped Hunger Games would have a similar feel. Maybe the third one does. No, I don't think Hunger Games is anything like Brazil, is it? I mean, it's futuristic and sci-fi in a way, but it's a totally different
vibe. It's not satire,
isn't it?
I mean, it's, yeah.
And there's something about The Hunger Games that is, going back to what I said about it, it much more speaks to the teenage self. So I'm not saying it's not appealing to adults, but it much more speaks to that evolving part of your life than it does. Brazil's just, the whole world's just completely about to fall off the end of the pier, isn't it?
Yeah, and in terms of YA novels, I think it's the strongest adaptation that we've seen, particularly from a gender point of view. And we haven't mentioned the Bechdel test in a few weeks, but this one passes the test.
It
whereas,
does, yes.
Say, Twilight and Divergent, and there was the Maze Runner, I think they're all pretty average.
A few more texts. Election, the movie, as a satire, and Legally Blonde as well. Love them both. Anything else to add quickly to Map to the Stars, Josh?
Go and see it. It's on limited release. It's only screening at Cinema Nova in Carlton.
Okay.
I've got two quick nominations for political satire. They're both directed by Barry Levinson.
Yeah.
Wag the Dog.
Oh, yes.
And Man of the Year, the Robin Williams film, if you're revisiting Robin Williams film this year. It's an interesting one.
Josh Nelson, thank you.
Pleasure.
Filmology.com is his website.